I'm Fraser T. Smith, a music artist, record producer, musician and songwriter, and I've made an album called 12 Questions under the name Future Utopia. Each track on the record poses a deep philosophical question, and I've invited some of the sharpest minds in popular culture to answer these questions in order to help me and others navigate living in the modern world. In this episode, I welcome world-renowned large-scale performative sculptor, stage designer and luminary, Ez Devlin, and musician, producer, visual artist and activist, Brian Eno. Ez Devlin, Brian Eno, I am in awe. I'm just going to get going because I'm so excited. And I know that I'm so respectful of your time and there's a lot of questions to get through. But I also wanted to just say in public how in awe I am of both of you as true icons in the creative field. As we got to know each other during Stormzy's 2018 performance, iconic performance at the Brits. We became friends on that with working together on some of the music and me hopefully giving you some of the things that you needed to make that performance so great. And then I did lots of investigation and started to get a real handle on all the incredible stuff that you've done across all the different disciplines of creativity. And I stumbled across an incredible TED talk where you were talking about connection. And it was at the point where I was putting together the 12 questions, and you very kindly invited me to your lovely home. And we spent about 2 hours talking about connection and division and all sorts of things. But that led to us collaborating on the question on the 12 Questions album, Why Are We Divided When We're So Connected? I feel proud that among all the incredible things that you've done all over the world in the creative field, I have been the first person to add you onto a rap track. Is that safe to say? In amongst all these crazy people that you've worked with, I do have to say that's one thing that I could feel that I've added to your illustrious CV. We've become great friends. We've done a show together at Bold Tendencies. We've done talks together. And the thing that I want to say, because everyone here is going to know the incredible work that you've done with the huge names, but the thing for me to always project on these podcasts is that we have become great friends, and you are one of the most caring torch bearers within the creative community. You care about the planet and you care about people, and you have so much humility. And that is something that I want to share with everyone here, because the CV and the Wikipedia is one thing, but everyone wants to know what the incredible people that I know, that I consider my friends, as everyone are on this podcast, are really like. And I cannot speak any higher words about you than the fact that you're just the most wonderful human being. Brian, you've obviously been, as a fellow musician and an artist and creator, you are someone that I've always held in such high esteem. I am thrilled that we are just starting our journey together as friends in working together on the incredible Earth Percent project, which we've come into contact through. And I love the fact that we could have come into contact in a recording studio making music, which will obviously be in a dream, but I love the fact that we've come together on something which is a bigger picture type of project. We've spoken once before, and we've had the most amazing hour. What's great about our relationship personally is the fact that I've obviously been a huge fan of your music over the decades, and for me, as my career has progressed, and similarly with you, Ez, the further you get in your career, the more you look to people, the more I look to people like the two of you to see what you're doing and to inspire me to think, well, Ez has been able to do this, and she's working at the Super Bowl, but then she's coming back and she's doing something else at Bold Tendencies in Peckham. Well, she's all these different things. And similarly to you, Brian, I've lived and died on your music over the decades, and then being married to Sarah, my lovely wife, who's a sculptor, she's turned me more onto your incredible artwork, and I've now become a dedicated follower of that. So that is inspiring and also plays into my imposter syndrome sometimes, because I sometimes think I'm doing well, and then I look at the two of you and think, actually, I haven't scratched the surface. So more work to be done, but that's inspiring. Just how are you both?
As imposters go, I'm feeling fine.
Do you ever have imposter syndrome, Ez?
Oh my God, of course. I mean, every good imposter has to see the imposter in the mirror. And there is no courage without the vulnerability of recognizing the hollowness within the shell that you build and try to shore up the shell from the interior. I can't imagine, Brian, can you, an artist who is honest and no. doesn't see the dissonance and the disconnect between the outward resonating bell that we try to be and the inward hollowness that a bell needs in order to resonate, right? It's something to do with that, isn't it? Isn't that the way instruments work, that they need a hollow belly to resonate in some way? I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, just as the human as instrument and the mechanics of that.
Yes, I mean, that it's a body of air inside an instrument. It's actually what is making the vibration, what is making the sound. So, yeah, there's a sort of absence, a vacuum that possibly exists inside everybody. And that's a malleable space. That's something that you can change the shape of. And I think what artists are doing generally is shape changing. They're inventing other worlds and other people to be in that world. I remember one recording session with Bowie once, where he was trying out different characters for the lead vocal, and he would sing a little bit, and then he'd say, "That was a bit lumberjack, wasn't it?" He'd say, "We want a little bit more spiff, don't we?" And so he was sort of moulding this personality to be the presenter of this song, and I've seen other singers do that often as well, and it makes me think that that's actually what artists are always doing. They're sort of trying to design a character or a little world and saying to you, the listener or the viewer, come on, see what this world is like. And that to me is what art does. It says, here's another possible world. What do you think about that? How do you feel about that? Because the truth is that art deals with our vocabulary of feelings, our repertoire of feelings, and says, here's a kind of feeling you could have. How do you feel about that? What do you think about it? Is it useful? Is it a being that you could inhabit? And is it a being that would help you in different ways to be alive in this world? So they're alternative propositions. That's what imagining is. Imagining is a way of creating in your mind a place that doesn't exist yet.
And I think that sort of brings us on to, doesn't it, Fraser, utopia, and what utopia can do as a mechanic, as a thought exercise and perspective shift, which, Brian, is what we touched on a bit when I came around to your house and we talked about the possibility of the word extinction. Because what's interesting is, when I was a kid, extinction was something that referred to dinosaurs. And dodos. And the big piece of perspective shift happened to me when I walked over Waterloo Bridge and there was a sign saying Extinction Rebellion. And I thought, wow, that's quite on the nose. Yes. No one's used that word in that way before. That choice of vocabulary of putting extinction and rebellion next to each other, it felt very radical. Mm-hmm. It felt brutal. And yet now that has reached the mainstream. We refer to extinction of ourselves in the future tense, in a way that we wouldn't have done, I'm going to say, even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's a piece of enormous perspective shift that has happened in I think, a very positive way, in that we can't address the shaping of this new utopia that perhaps minimizes the possibility of our own extinction unless we really look down the barrel of the reality of the current future prospects, which is human extinction, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I've really found with these questions and living inside them for 18 months now, I've really started to think about polarity and positivity, but how that relates to blind faith, and how you can only really have true connection with division. You can only really have nature with nurture. And a lot of the questions which are quite divisive and very polarizing, I've experienced a lot of that myself within the making of this. I've experienced huge highs, but huge lows. I've experienced huge amounts of connection, but huge amounts of division, huge amounts of love and a certain amount of pain. But I feel that the more that I've spent within these questions, I'm feeling that you can't really have one thing without the other. So it's what you're saying, Ez. It is the two poles.
I have a question for Brian on this. Brian, when we last met, I don't think I touched on this book by David Abram that is now really shaping my thought a little bit, and I'm not sure if you're aware of it. It's a couple of books. One's called The Spell of the Sensuous, and the other one is called Becoming Animal. And he's an eco-philosopher who was a sleight-of-hand magician. So clearly my kind of guy I'm desperate to meet. But his hypothesis is that, you know, in asking himself the question, when did this disconnect between the human species and the rest of the biosphere begin? If you're trying to find the inception of that parting of the ways, when was it?
Well, by naming things, we have the ability to establish sort of other separate entities in the universe. Ez Devlin, a book, a fire, something like that. So, and then we start naming things that perhaps aren't as clearly physical as that. Hatred, distress. We start giving names to things. And having given names to things, we start seeing them everywhere. Naming is a process of creating things, actually. It's a process of separating off a little bit of the world and saying that exists. And once we have a name, we tend to impose it on the world. It isn't the case that it grows out of the world and we think, oh, what's the name for that? And I'll invent the name. It's that we have these names and we impose them onto what we see around us. So whatever the shape of what we see around us, we've got a name for something, and we tend to impose like a cookie cutter onto a section of reality and say, this is what I mean by this word, whatever that word is. So that, to me, creates a fundamental both strength and weakness in the way humans interact with the rest of the world, which is that as the world changes, our language doesn't necessarily keep up with it. So we've got this cookie cutter that is called, let's say, patriotism. That's the kind of word that is a cookie cutter that we put onto experience. And then over time, the nature of what we might have meant by patriotism is changing, but the cookie cutter is still in the same place. So it's now describing the wrong set of experiences. But we fail to notice that.
I always think that about the word horizontal, because horizontal is the definition of a straight line, and yet it derives from the word horizon, which we used to think was a straight line. And one of the most fundamental shifts that we ever went through as a species was to manage to hold the dissonant beliefs that I feel like I'm walking on flat ground, the horizon looks straight, but I know because I believe it, because I've been told it, because science has proved it, that the Earth is actually a sphere, you know. And that for me is the kind of perspective shift that is absolutely antithetical to every atom of our fabric in our bodies. We think, you know, everything's horizontal. We need to go through that kind of shift in relation to climate change, in relation to our own. It's that kind of holding two things that are mutually exclusive, and our language won't catch up. Our language is the archaeology of what we used to think. And I think, Fraser, to your point in your discoveries on the journey of making the 12 questions piece, is connection and disconnection have to be held in equal weight, in the way that imposter and integrity, in relation to your first question, being authentic and being an imposter, somehow we have to be both, don't we? I don't know, is that too simple?
We really do. We really do. We've just answered another question before we've even got to the questions there as well. What's in a name? Question four.
That's the question I was having most difficulty with understanding what that meant, because there are so many philosophical discussions about that idea, and they all come from...
Well, I think you gave a great insight just then to the whole... I've never thought about what you were saying about what's in a name. Obviously, what I love about these questions is that they can be so immediate or so far ranging. It's really just the how far we want to twist the lens of the camera, really, when we're looking at them. But shall I launch into to question one?
I just want to comment on something Ez just said, if I may. So one way of thinking about the evolution of the human brain is, or the human mind, is of a process of gradually realizing that we are not at the center of things. Mm. So if you think of the shock of Copernicus was in revealing that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. In fact, it wasn't the center really of anything. It was at the edge of a solar system that was not at the center of a not very large galaxy that was not at the center of the universe. So that first shock was realizing that we were nothing in particular in the universe. You know, we were just a little bit of dust on the edges somewhere. But the next huge shock was with Darwin, showing that we weren't at the center of creation otherwise. You know, apart from not being at the center of the universe, we weren't even particularly at the center of life as we saw it. The shock was showing that there was nothing particularly special about us as animals, except for this fact that we had something that you might call human intelligence, which was seen as placing us closer to God, even by Darwin, incidentally. Well, it turns out we're not really particularly special in that respect either. We've developed something beyond what other animals have done, but it isn't unique to us. You know, we now know that higher primates and some birds and so on have consciousnesses that are not entirely distinct from ours. So I think what we've been going through is this gradual process of decentering, and that has led us to a sort of ecological consciousness of seeing that we are connected with everything. We're not the victors that sit on the top of it, but we're part of it as well. So that's the good side about the shift in consciousness that presumably David Abrahams is speaking about. Mm.
Do you, both of you, well, are huge, huge personalities in your own right, but you're also, what we share is that we've also been people that have helped huge stars and obviously gained from working with great stars. But does that, when I was saying about the imposter syndrome and polarity, I've really felt that when there have been things that have happened which have been the most successful in the public eye, I've felt then that there's this pull into feeling like I'm an imposter. Do you, when working with artists like Bowie and obviously recently Abel again from The Weeknd, as when these mega stars reach the heights, are you able to talk to them in that way, Brian and Ez, in making them understand that, I mean, it would be very hard for Abel to understand that he isn't maybe at the center of the universe after having done an incredible performance at the Super Bowl, or David Bowie having released Hunky Dory or any one of the albums, to calm that kind of ego, the ego that maybe is necessary to push yourself forward into these situations. How does that relate when you're working with these kind of megastars?
I mean, Brian has got far more experience than me, so should answer this in more detail, but briefly to say that I feel fortunate in that the collaborators I'm lucky enough to learn from and collaborate with and share ideas with are generally conscious of character in the way that Brian was describing earlier. They know that they are assuming a character. They know that it's like putting a costume on. You know, they are investing themselves literally with character. They put it on, they take it off, and the healthier they are, the more they are aware of the definition, the delineation between themselves and their investiture, the character that they wear to perform. And it's armor as well, it's protection. Because if you don't draw a line, you'll be vulnerable. And the ones I've worked with who have been most vulnerable and have made themselves a bit unwell here and there to different degrees, as all of us have been because their armor, their costume, their character, their cloak just wasn't quite complete. They weren't fully protected and they weren't able to fully use it in a resonant way and then take it off and be a barefoot creature at the end of the night. Brian, what's your experience?
My experience is I wish I'd had you as the psychologist on a few of the projects I've been involved with. Because I think that's very much the process that's going on. And I think people generally do it intuitively without that much awareness of of what it is that's happening. My feeling is that I've been lucky in working with people who were generally intelligent, compassionate and sensitive. So it never felt like it was a sort of imposition to want to talk about these things. It felt like it was part of the process. You know, this is what we're doing, and how do we understand ourselves and it to make it work better? So I don't think I've ever been in a situation where somebody has said, "Oh, fuck, shut up, Brian, will you? Who's going on about this intellectual crap?" People sometimes laugh about it because I do go on a bit, but it's a welcoming kind of laugh, you know. Oh, here he goes again.
I think so. I think the peripheral structures around fame and celebrity are now so exposed, and I think artists, musicians, composers are aware of the structures. They use them very consciously. Because they need to, so they're very conscious of those, and they respect the boundaries of them. And I think so many of their interactions are mediated through those peripheral structures around celebrity that they're rather relieved when they sit down and they know that this is going to be a chat human to human. And quite often, you know, I might not even know of, you know, because I'm a little bit out of touch occasionally as well. I might be sitting down and having a conversation that is actually quite unaware of some of the activities within those peripheral structures, because I haven't quite been paying attention because I was reading a book. And they're quite relieved sometimes that you don't know what they just did or what was just said about them in the tabloid, because you just weren't aware because you were busy doing something else and there aren't enough hours in the day, frankly. So that can be a relief to people, actually.
Yes, I mean, it's the reason that people in the public eye tend to hang out with other people in the public eye. One of the reasons is because there are lots of bits of conversation you don't have to have with somebody else who's already well known. Because the worst thing is meeting someone who just wants to talk about how famous you are. It's totally depressing. It just makes you feel sad because they just want to talk about you. And actually, the last thing I'm really interested in talking about is me.
I mean, I do think also, you know, respecting the moment that an artist has just performed or is just about to perform, when they go into that kind of trance-like state of entering character or that vulnerable state of emerging from character, that there I think different rules apply. And there I think, you know, anyone around that artist when they're about to go on stage or when they've just come off stage has to be mindful of this kind of trance that they're in, that they've had to enter in, to do their job of communicating to fucking, you know, millions of people, because that's a hard job. You're a warrior. And I think all bets are off there. I think everyone has to converge towards the necessary environment and energy to support that performer as they go on, as they come off, you know? And I think that's a special moment to observe. Would you agree, Brian? You know?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you an interesting story about that, actually also involving Bowie. We were working in Switzerland on an album, and somebody on the reception desk said, "Oh, there are four kids from Paris outside. They heard you were working here, and they've come down and want to say hello. They've driven down from Paris to Montreux in Switzerland." Now, my reaction to situations like that is rather cruel, and I would say, "Well, tell them to fuck off." But David didn't do that. He said, invite them in. So they came into the studio, into the control room, these four kind of gaga young people, like with wide eyes. And then David was about to do a vocal that day, and he went into the studio. And suddenly I saw him do something that I'd never seen him do before, which is that he suddenly became David Bowie in front of the microphone. The studio was connected by a camera. So they were sort of watching on a TV screen in the control room. And he was standing at the mic in this sort of "I am an artist" fashion. And I thought, Jesus, that's so fake, David. I know you never do that in real life. But then afterwards I thought, but actually he was using the situation in a very interesting way. He was thinking, I'm going to take the presence of these four people to become David Bowie, to go into that state that you're just talking about there. And in fact, he did a really good vocal in that condition, you know. And I thought, yeah, that was intelligent. He sort of just took advantage of this fact of, here I have a tiny little audience of people who aren't sick of seeing me every day, not sitting there kind of looking at the paper while I try to do a vocal, four people whose attention is absolutely rapt on me, and I'll do that thing. And I think you're absolutely right. It's a state that one goes into, and one needs help. One needs attention for it.
There was a story about Marilyn Monroe, wasn't there, that where she was walking down Fifth Avenue, but in a, she had a headscarf on, and she was walking in a way that didn't, no one would have associated with Marilyn Monroe. She had a big coat on, and someone was walking with her, with, it was a journalist, and she said, just what's this? So she's walking down the street, busy, busy street, no one paying any attention to her. She just took the headscarf off and just straightened her shoulders and just walked like Marilyn Monroe, and within seconds she was mobbed.
Yes.
It's incredible how you can just...
I've seen the same thing with Bono.
Wow.
it was very funny. He came to see me at my studio in London, and we went out for a coffee, and he took his glasses off. You know, this is when he was in that phase of wearing colourful wraparound glasses. He took his glasses off, and we were just walking along, chatting happily. And then we sat down in a cafe, outside in a cafe, and he put the glasses back on, and suddenly he was Bono again, and all these people were around us. So I thought, that's quite amazing. A good technique. If you wear an identifying thing like that, when you take it off, you're kind of saying to people, I'm actually not Bono at the moment, so just leave me alone.
But I think that goes back to the mask and the use of the mask in Greek theatre, doesn't it? Because mm-hmm. I think the makeup, certainly Adele's makeup, she puts that eye on. You know, it's Maria Callas, it's this mask, which goes back to the Greek, even those glasses, it's a mask.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the mask has historically been used, again, coming back to this question we started off with the musical instruments, using the face as an instrument and understanding. And we disassociate it somewhat because we know it's part of our, you know, artillery in a way.
Yes, yes.
Do I mean artillery? A part of our arsenal is the word I'm looking for. Yeah, it's part of our instrumentation. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything that you can ensure has been separated off like that. So.
There's going to be, I don't know if you have people, there's a few people I know that I've only ever met with masks on, and I'm really curious to see after lockdown what my physio actually really looks like, because he's only talked to me. I mean, he could have three mouths, and you know, it could be a completely, his teeth, I can only imagine what his teeth are like, or but literally our relationship has been masked from start to finish, not to finish, but to this point, six, eight, 12 months. So it's, I think we're going to...
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, Brian, when you and I last met, we were talking about your choir, and I'd love you to tell us what's happened with that during lockdown, because of course, when we were talking about, you know, the oxytocin that's released when you sing together, yes, and the beneficial hormonal and health qualities of choral singing and singing together. And of course, during the pandemic, singing became toxic. Singing became an instrument of mass destruction. So let's talk about that.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right that we had to stop. Aside from anything else, I was no longer in London. I came out of London to lock down, and I've been out of London ever since. So the choir has been going for about 20 years or more, and this is certainly by far the longest break we've ever had. Occasionally we've had a couple of months over summer when people were not around that we didn't sing.
And you didn't do like a Zoom choir or anything, Brian? You didn't want to try and...
It doesn't work. No. We tried it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work at all. I mean, the most important thing about singing together is singing together, the coordination and the feeling of losing yourself in a bigger sound, which is a fascinating feeling. I mean, I think any singer has had it, where you suddenly are not any longer aware of which voice is yours. You're just part of the singing. I remember in Ghana, I worked with some drummers once, and I was recording them, and we were setting up microphones and so on. And I said to the drummers, I said, I'm just going to go around and check individual mics. And I said to one of the players, can you play your part just so I can hear that on its own? And he said, no. And I said, why, what? I said, why not? He said, I don't really know what I'm playing if the other people aren't playing. And this is something that I think really happens a lot when you're singing with a group of other singers, where if you take them away, you don't actually know what your part is. It only appears in relation to what everybody else is doing. And this is a wonderful feeling, I think, because it's a sort of dissolution of ego that you don't get easily out of situations that don't involve love and sex. You get the same thing then.
Yeah.
Or religion. You get it in religion, I think, as well. This sense of no longer being one, but being a part of something big. Now, you remember at the beginning we were talking about the evolution of consciousness, and I said the big split is when you realize that you're separate from the rest of the world. And I think in certain activities that we humans love doing, sex, drugs, art and religion in particular, we deliberately create situations in which we go back to that condition of being part of something, of not being separate, not being separated. And I call that surrender. So in our everyday life, we have a repertoire of responses to the things that happen around us. And mostly what we think about are the responses that are to do with control. How do I change things, or how do I manipulate things so that they suit me better? You know, that's the basis of technical civilization. How do I change things so that they're more comfortable for me? And, right, we're very good at that as humans. We're brilliant at it, actually. That's the basis of everything we do most of the time, like what we're doing now. We're talking on an apparatus that evolved through the need or the ability to control some things. But there are lots of situations where control isn't possible because we don't know enough about the situation, or is not desirable. So I always like the analogy of surfing, where, well, I don't surf, by the way, but I like I admire people who do, and I like watching it. But when you're surfing, what you're doing is you're constantly moving between controlling and surrendering. You need control to get onto the wave, and then you surrender. You're carried along by the wave. And it seems to me nearly all of the things that humans do for pleasure involve being able to move along that axis between control and surrender. Mm. There are very few situations where you can totally control. That's what scientific experiments are about. They're about trying to eliminate from the experiment any effects that you can't control for. But those are relatively rare situations in our experience. Most of the time we're operating on intuitions and feelings and hunches and half-formed information, traditions, inherited thoughts. It's a mess. How we come to decisions is a complete mess. And it's something we constantly are rethinking and refashioning for every situation in which we have to make decisions. But the people who do it well are the people who also know how to surrender. And surrendering means saying, if I can't control a situation, what is the best strategy to use? And the best strategy is to go with it, to go with the flow. Now, people who don't surrender get hurt quite easily, because if you try to control something that's too strong for you and you try to deal with it by remaining stiff and rigid, you get broken. If you become supple and flowy, you might survive. You might go with it.
There's two things that come to mind here, which is one, oblique strategies, which we should talk about because we have the deck here and we use it daily. And then the other is anti-fragility. But can you just talk to us a bit about oblique strategies? Because I think that's really valuable for people to know about.
Yes. When I first started recording in the early 70s, when studios were very expensive, I noticed that the kind of panic that the clock induced in the studio forced you into quick and habitual decisions. So the panic, the pressure of the price and the bill going up, tended to make you not want to experiment too much. nothing worse, it seemed, than spending a day and not having a result at the end of it because you'd just been experimenting. And yet, often walking home from the studio, I'd think, do you know, if I'd only remembered this idea or that idea, I think we could have got a better result. And it was first of all to do with memory that I would think of things outside of the studio, but then in the pressure of the situation, I wouldn't remember to do them, or they seemed too risky or something like that. They didn't seem in the list of possible thoughts. So in particular, the first thing I thought about was, in much of what I do when I'm not under pressure, I tend to take mistakes quite seriously, in the sense that I think, is that mistake actually more interesting than what I intended to do? If there's an outcome which isn't what I intended, do I just try to beat it into shape so it becomes what I intended? Or do I look at it and think, what's in there that is valuable that I didn't imagine, I didn't think of before? So my very first idea that led to Oblique Strategies was, it was written like one of the commandments. It said, honor thy error as a hidden intention. And so for a little while, I'd have that on the control desk in the studio, honor thy error as a hidden intention, just to remind myself that that was a way of looking at things. So as the weeks went on, I would add other ones to this. I had other little ideas in the list, like I'd found, for instance, that if you stepped outside of the studio and listened to the music with the door shut, you would hear things that you didn't hear in the studio. In particular, you'd hear what the rhythm section was doing, because in the studio, you're always overwhelmed by listening to the stuff on top, what the voice is doing, what all the loud stuff is doing. Shut the door, and you suddenly hear what the bass and drums are doing. You hear the music in a different way. So that was another one, saying, shut the door, go outside, shut the door, I think it was. Anyway, after a little while, I had quite a list of these, and there were too many of them to actually be useful, because none of them stood out, and you'd end up looking at the one that was most convenient anyway. And I was talking to my friend Peter Schmidt, who's a painter, about my list, and he said, oh, I've got a list like that as well, in relation to painting. And we compared our two lists, and they had a lot of overlaps. Turned out there were many of these things that you could apply to both painting and to making music. So we then decided to make this pack of cards, and it really came about with the reason it was cards rather than a book was because it was important to choose just one.
Yeah.
You know, so take it and do it, whatever it says. Even if it's not convenient, it doesn't seem to fit with what you're doing. That's the whole point. The whole point is to push you out of the groove of habit that you would otherwise fall into.
We use them on my Zoom calls now with my studio, Brian. Each time we do a group studio call, one of my team has the deck in his house and he says, right, well, this is what the card says today.
Oh, good. That's so nice. Yeah, that's really nice to hear.
I used it as well all the time. And I just was thinking, as I remembered, I and I'm sure you guys are the same, when you have artists in, I end up giving most of my stuff away and then I forget to buy stuff again. You're just, you know, someone will look at something in the studio and go, oh, that's great, like an effects pedal or the cards. And they'll go, that's fantastic. So look, have it. And then you get into the moment and you forget to rebuy stuff.
You need to buy Oblique Strategies. You need to buy them in 10 packs.
Yeah, that's what we need to do.
You buy 10 at a time.
Yeah,
and then you draw them out like that.
That's what I'm going to do.
But anti-fragility is something, you know, I only learned the word about a year ago. Nassim Taleb's word, which was so useful during the pandemic and in the wake of the pandemic. As you say, the things that survive are the things that are able to change, are not brittle, become anti-fragile through their adaptability. And we've seen such an acceleration in our awareness. It's almost been like a kind of invisible ink wash that went over every system that exists. Yeah. And sort of immediately drew out those that were anti-fragile and have thrived in the face of this wash of conflict and trauma that the pandemic has unleashed, those that have thrived and those that have struggled. And it's to do with anti-fragility, isn't it?
Yes.
And changeability.
Yes, that's a very useful idea, I think. I mean, I first came into contact with that notion in a brilliant book by the war journalist Fitzgerald. Her name is, I can't remember her first name now. I read it in the early 70s, and it's a book called Fire Over the Lake, and she was talking about the Vietnam War, which she had reported on. And the main message of the book was about the difference between what the Americans were doing there and what the Vietnamese were doing. And she sums it up by saying the Americans were playing chess and the Vietnamese were playing Go.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Go is that it's all about anti-fragility. It's not about having big, powerful pieces that go out onto the landscape and sort of establish their position. It's about having lots and lots of pieces, all of the same value, because there's no difference between any of the pieces in a Go game. And it's about the implications of power and the flow of power in a situation. And it became so clear reading her book why the American effort had failed so badly there, because they were trying to throw heavy artillery at what was essentially a river, a river of people. Mm. It didn't matter if you destroyed a little bit of it. It made no difference. There was no command structure, really, for them to attack. It was a sort of surrender structure rather than a command structure, which is the difficulty that conventional armies always have with guerrilla. Sorry, I'm getting a bit technical here, I realise, going into the history of warfare. Perhaps what we should do, Fraser, I realise that we haven't answered one of the questions on your list yet.
But actually, we've answered so many of them. So I was thinking about this, and I think that this episode can take on a different form, because we're actually being supple and we're not trying to control things. So I'm taking in everything that you're both saying, that we're going with the flow, and I think the flow of this is incredible. But one question that I do want us to pose within this, because I know that you're both so passionate about climate change and saving the planet, is it too late to save the planet?
Well, I was going to talk about something in relation to something you said earlier, which is that for me the question isn't binary. It's not a question of is it extinction or not extinction. It's actually much worse than that. The question is, how many degrees is it going to be? There's a very interesting book by Mark Linus, the environmentalist, called 6 Degrees, and he just paints the picture of what each degree of climate change means for the future. So if it's 2 degrees, what does it do to sea levels, to land usage, to, you know, animal diversity and so on? If it's 3 degrees, what does it do? If it's 4, if it's 5? And it isn't going to be a clean choice between is it a good future or a bad one. It's really a question of how bad can we not let it be?
Yeah.
So the problem with the binary distinction is that it either drives people towards ineffective optimism, where they think, oh, it's all going to work out all right. Somebody's going to come up with a technical solution and it will all be fine. And that has been a very strong disincentive for people to get involved, because there have been enough people saying we only need to develop new forms of renewable energy and everything will be all right. Just leave it to industry and, you know, the normal workings of capitalism too, and something will come up. Don't worry, it'll be fine. And that seems ludicrous to some of us, but that was a strong thought in Silicon Valley for a long time, because these are basically techno-utopians or techno-optimists who think that there must be a technical solution to every problem, because there often has been in the past. So that's a problem. The other problem with that binary view is that a lot of people think, oh dear, there's no hope. What's the point in bothering? I might as well just have as good a time as I can now and just not think about the future. There's no point in it. It's just a waste of time. So I always argue for the Mark Linus position, which is saying we've got to start making choices, because, you know, what we do now determines whether we get to there or to there or to there. So I'm optimistic in the sense that I don't think, even in quite extreme scenarios, that we're going to see the total end of humanity in the next 200 years. But I do think that we could quite quickly see the collapse of what we know of as civilization quite soon. And in fact, a lot of people would argue that we've started out on that road already. Mm. And that is quite worrying, because it's not just about whether we're alive, it's about what world we live in and what quality of life we have. And that's quite under threat. So where do I see optimism? I see, for the first time ever in human history, a global social movement, which is called environmentalism. Mm. I think there's never been a larger consciousness of a single issue in all human minds. There are billions of people involved in this in some way or another, and that is something quite new. I think, as the Russian historian Alexei Yerchak said in his great book about the end of the Soviet Union, which is called Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More, which is a great title, I think. But the book is about the possibility of sudden radical change in a society. And he's writing about what happened in Russia when one day there was Soviet Russia and the next day it was gone, absolutely overnight like that. And the world didn't collapse. That's the important thing. And the reason the world didn't collapse was because in the previous 20 or 25 years of the Soviet experience, as the system got less and less efficient at actually doing anything, people had made their own workarounds. So people had their own ways of making things happen. The government still sat there on top, looking as if it was in control of everything. But actually, most of the things that worked in Russia worked because people kept them going spontaneously. And so there was a lot of bottom-up organization in Russia. So when the system disappeared, not everything disappeared. Suddenly, all of those informal relationships became how you did things. And in Yerchak's book, he has a sentence, I believe he does, because I've never been able to find the sentence again in the book, so I'm now starting to wonder whether I made it up when I was reading the book. But I think he says, revolutions come in two phases. The first phase is when everybody realizes that something is wrong. The second phase is when everybody realizes that everybody else realizes it as well. And this is, I think, the point we're getting to now. And this I call this in my head, I call this coalescence, the point at which everybody looks around and realizes, oh, I'm not the exception. I'm not the only person thinking this. Actually, this is what everyone's thinking. The exceptions are those few people in government and the media who think that they're in control of everything. But they're not anymore, actually. Once we look around, we see the billions of us who are all trying to fight the same fight in some way. As soon as we realize that, we're in control of it. And I think we're on the cusp of that coalescence now.
I mean, I wonder, Brian, whether, you know, having read some of what Wagner wrote, you know, good and bad, what's interesting is that he wrote more lines on vegetarianism than any other subject, than anti-Semitism, than anything else, as you know, to do with his, you know, attitude towards Schopenhauer, to do with his learnings around Buddhism. And I think is a fundament of this, our attitude towards animals, our attitude towards plants, our attitude towards what we eat and what we kill. Because it seems to me if we, as ways into this, and we talk about the horizon, the archaeology of our language, but the fundamental perspective shift that most of us, not all of us, but most of us do all now fundamentally understand that the earth is spherical. Could we make that kind of shift in our attitude towards other living beings? Could we stop eating them? could that happen? Because that seems to me like step one. If we stopped killing things and stopped eating them, that would just be the most extraordinary shift and such a massive part towards the shifts that we need to make in our, you know, attitude towards land and the planet.
Yes. Well, I think one of the most interesting technical developments is lab meat.
Exactly.
If that could really become a thing, and I'm pretty confident it will within 6-10 years, it will be cheaper than real meat, because real meat is so expensive in planetary terms. There was an article by George Monbiot about a year ago where he's talking about the true cost of beef. The true cost is not only that we produce this very expensive and kind of somewhat immoral form of food for each other, but that also the land on which we're doing it is not doing something else. Mm. So, you know, that 70% of the deforestation on the planet is to produce meat, basically. We deforest the Amazon in order to grow soy, in order to feed cattle, in order to make beef. So if we stop doing that, if somehow there was some kind of PR campaign, I mean, I would be willing to put a lot of money into a campaign like this, which said to people, eating beef, it's kind of dirty and unhygienic and not very nice to animals and so on and so on. What about this wonderful new thing we've got, this lab meat, which has no ethical downside, is in ecological terms hundreds of times cheaper. That would be a huge change. We could save the forests by doing
that. Well, Netflix did Game Changers, wasn't it? It was that fantastic piece about elite sports people and how, you know, the strongest person in the world, the fastest person in the world, was so much faster and stronger because they were vegetarian or vegan even. And just literally showing the experiments that when they ate a chicken versus when they ate something that was vegetarian, you know, their analysis of their blood and their hormone levels and, you know, their achievement in sport was so much higher without the debris of the meat in their system. So that was, you know, I think Netflix did a really good piece there. But I think for me, that feels like, obviously there are, you know, 20 different, 200 different ways in to chip away at the perspective shift necessary. That for me feels like an immediate one to go after. And then I think the simple Attenborough thing of just don't waste a thing, you know, that feels to me like a really good thing to have stuck onto your door in the morning. Just every single light that doesn't need to be on, you know, the smallest things across your entire, you know, engagement, just don't waste a thing, whatever it is.
Yes.
But yeah, we have to chip away, don't we? I mean,
well, and I think we are, you know. I mean, I thought I had it here. I've just finished reading here it is, a book that I want to show you because it's such an incredibly wonderful book. It's by an Australian woman, and it's about a subject that might seem very hackneyed now, whales. But it's so incredibly interesting to find out the complexity of the life of whales and of how they interweave with the life of the rest of the planet. They're very central creatures. And I think gradually more and more work like that is showing us how valuable all the other life on the planet is, how it's not just a sort of question of sentimentality that we think we should look after whales and so on. That's not even the beginning of it. You know, it's nothing to do with sentimentality. It's a sort of pragmatic understanding that the whole system evolved together and needs itself. You know, it needs all its bits. And that if you suddenly dramatically remove a part of the system, even if it's quite a small part in number terms, it has a resonance throughout the whole system. So I think we're all becoming much more aware of the density of those interconnections and how interdependent we are. And I see books like this coming every day. This is a particularly good one because she's such a fabulous writer. Mm. It's like reading a very long poem, actually, the book. I very much recommend it.
Paul Hawken's book is good as well. The
Blessed Unrest.
No, the Paul Hawken one I'm thinking about is called Drawdown. It's the most comprehensive plan ever to reverse global warming. And he goes through, he's done this analysis, peer reviewed, of each strategy to reverse, not just reduce, but reverse global warming. And of course, the top of his list is refrigeration and air conditioning, which is huge and hard to solve.
Yes, especially if you're eating a lot of meat, that's when you need the refrigeration.
I mean, the answers that you guys gave, it made me think of Katrin Friedrich's answer to the question, my great friend and abstract artist, in that she, in answering, is it too late to save the planet, said that the planet can survive without humans, but humans can't survive without the planet. And I love what you were saying about whales and how we are, in essence, obviously all connected, yet sometimes we feel about saving the planet as though the planet is this thing that we're not connected to. And it's actually, we really need to save ourselves, and we need to educate, and we need to inform, and we need to look at our because the planet is doing just fine. Well, it's not because of us, but it's interesting that we can, when we talk about climate change, I think the through media, it can feel like the planet is separate to the human race.
Have you looked at the book? I talk about it a lot. I think maybe I've mentioned it to you before, Fraser, the Margaret Atwood, the Flood series, Oryx and Crake.
Yes.
If you've read that one.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In Oryx and Crake, it's a little bit like the storyline of Minority Report in that it's what she calls, you know, she doesn't call it science fiction, she calls it possible futures. And in this possible future, humans have evolved in two directions. One, to sort of devolve into the most kind of animal form, I guess, or not devolve, but become at its most carnal. And then the other segment of humanity has become uncorporeal, you know, pure intelligence. The information in Yuval Noah Harari's kind of Homo Deus aspect of it. And I'm afraid I observe in my children, especially during a year of being locked down in their bedrooms, almost what appears to me like a kind of evolutionary imperative to exist without the planet in their mind, exist on these imaginary planets in Fortnite and Minecraft, and exist within a sort of mirror maze feedback code of pure pixels, because they feel safer there, because they feel that is, they hear so much of us and our generation talking about the threats to their environment and to their interaction with the biosphere, that it's almost like they're retreating into this, you know, man-made, human-made pixel world, because they feel that this is solid ground. They feel this is more reliable. It's a terrifying thing. And if you ask me what matters most, it's, I look at my children who are, you know, 11 and 13, how do we bring them back from the brink to trust their connection now? You know, I can barely get them in, this is a bad story, but I tried to take them out to the beach during the middle of one of the lockdowns, and I couldn't get them off their devices in the car to come and look at the sea, because they felt more comfortable with a fucking pixelated sea. Because again, control and surrender, they felt more in control of that world. They felt safer. They felt it wasn't going to be threatened. And this, I think, is a real thing to contend, and perhaps what matters most in my life at the moment.
It's a sort of terrifying thought, isn't it? But I think one of the things that we have always tended to do as humans is to prefer the framed version of things. I remember when I first had a video camera, this was in the 70s, I got my first colour video camera, and I didn't have a stand for it. So I just laid it sideways on the windowsill. I was living in New York at the time. And so there was mostly sky on the screen, and I had to turn the screen sideways as well, because I'd put the camera sideways. So suddenly I had a picture. It didn't look like television, it looked like a painting. And I thought, oh, that's lovely, using video to make paintings. And I just used to sit and look at this screen, which was actually a picture of what was outside my window. It was the sky and the tops of buildings. And people used to come and visit me, and they would sit and look at the screen as well. And I thought, isn't it interesting that we all prefer the framed version? We all find that interesting and engaging. And it's because the frame is a sort of control. It says, this is the bit you look at. Don't worry about all the rest of it. Just look at this bit. So I don't think that thing your children are doing is new. I think that's something, landscape painting, after all, is that same sort of idealization of taking something and then taking a bit of it and saying, okay, here's the bit to look at. And it's a sort of aestheticization of things. But I don't think it's bad, because landscape painting is what made us sensitive to landscapes, actually. Before landscape painting, I don't think people looked at landscapes
right.
in the same way.
Yeah.
So I think it's a learning process as well. I think your children will understand realities that we don't understand at all. I mean, I see this already happening when I think about what is happening to people's sense of how value is created in things. You've probably all heard in the last few weeks about NFTs, non-fungible tokens. Suddenly everybody's making non-fungible tokens. I must have had a dozen emails about them, people asking me to make a non-fungible token with them in the last few weeks.
I've had some of those.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you told me what it was, actually, because I was about to look it up.
Yeah, NFT, National Film Theatre.
That's what I thought.
When I first thought, I thought, oh, National Film Theatre is getting very adventurous.
Well, it's actually, it's Neil Tennant's initials, so I thought it was something to do with him. But anyway, now you've you lightened me, so now I know.
Well, you know, this is a sort of different understanding of something that is very, very important to all of us, which is what do we value and how do we come to value it?
Mm.
And how do we exchange that value or perpetuate it or whatever we want to do with it? And so suddenly discovering in the last few weeks, there's this whole new way of creating value, of, in fact, it's of inventing value, really, because you're not finding it in those things, you're conferring it upon them. So this goes back to something that I've been thinking about for years, which is, where is the value in a piece of art? Is it in the art? So if you know, Michelangelo's La Pietà was sitting in a closed, dark room with nobody looking at it, does it still have value then? I don't think it does, actually. It has value in its transaction with us, in our relationship. The value is a relationship. And this sort of understanding of the shift of value being from stuff, substance, to being something to do with relationships is important, I think. And our children will understand that much, much better than we do, I believe.
That is true, actually. In fact, the conversation I had with Ludo, I called him Ludo, so I shouldn't be surprised that he's a gamer. But you know, the conversation last night was around the stories he was telling me and the investitures he had purchased with real money.
Yes.
And me saying, what happens to these? Where do you keep these things of value? But you're right. The fact that to our children, stuff can be made of code rather than mind matter. But then we come on to a question which we can't answer here about how much power is used in the streaming and in the devices. You know, that's a whole other question in terms of the carbon footprint of pixels.
Yes, that is, and it's an increasingly important question, actually. But probably, as you say, outside of the brief of this particular conversation.
Like mining Bitcoin, I'm desperate to talk about that, but another one, another conversation.
I feel like this could just be, the whole series could just be with the two of you. I mean, I feel like I've been...
Let's do that.
But we must
sing. I'm enjoying it.
But we've got to sing. If we're doing that, we have to sing. Brian, please let me join your choir. I know you weren't sure about my voice quality, but next time, let me audition.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Well, you said you do have to be able to sing, but I didn't get a chance to audition. But next time, when it comes out of lockdown, please let me audition at least and see if I'm worthy, because I want to be in that choir.
Oh, God, it would be wonderful. But we don't really have auditions, you know.
Okay, well, I'll just turn up then.
Yeah.
I'll just tell you one quick story about where my imposter syndrome really kicked in. I was in the studio in Florida with an amazing lady called Celine Dion. And I was trying to get her to do something on the talkback mic. I was literally with her for one day. And now, Brian, I know you've got an incredible voice. My voice sounds like, with all due respect to Elvis Costello, a very drunk Elvis Costello, even though I'm not drunk. So I was trying to get her to sing this note going into the last chorus. And I went on the talkback mic and I said, Celine, you know, I just feel like you could push up a little bit from that last chorus. And she said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, just, you know, the note you're going to at the minute, desperately trying not to sing on the mic with my junk Elvis Costello voice, which wouldn't have helped her anyway, because, you know, the for me, a C, it could be a B, it could be a C sharp. I mean, it's not helping. So I just tried and I tried. And then there was a silence behind the talkback mic. And she said, well, just sing it. I said, Celine, I really don't think that's going to be necessary. She goes, well, just do it. Just do it. I could tell, you know, she was losing her patience and just wanted to get on with it. I said, well, okay. It sort of goes like, and there was silence from the vocal booth. And she just said very dryly, I guess we will not be doing a duet on this track, will we? So the imposter syndrome kicked in massively. But guys, I feel like I've checked into a mental spa here for an hour listening to you. I feel refreshed. I feel renewed. I feel whole. And listening to your thoughts and ideas, I thank you so much for coming on to this 12 Questions podcast. And long may your creative genius continue to permeate the minds and senses of all of us who just love seeing your creations and can't wait to see what you both get up to next.
Thank you so much, Fraser. And thank you too, Ez. It's lovely to speak to you.
Yeah, great to see you both again. See you again soon for the next episode.
Both. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, I need to lie down after that. Let's be clear, the format of this podcast is that I ask the guests each of the 12 questions. But I guess when you've got geniuses like Brian Eno and Ez Devlin on, you ask them one question and you get the 12 answers for free. I first met Ez in 2018 when we were both working on the music and set for Storms' iconic Brits performance that year, and I immediately became a huge fan of her work. I later stumbled across a brilliant TED talk Ez had done where she discusses division and connection in such a powerful way, and this talk was still resonating with me as I pondered the question, why are we divided when we're so connected, for my album, and I thought Ez would be the perfect artist to pair with Dave on the song Children of the Internet. Ez kindly invited me into her home and we talked about the question for a couple of hours, and I captured her profound words on tape and used it on the track. You can hear Children of the Internet on the album 12 Questions by me, Fraser T. Smith, aka Future Utopia, available on all the major streaming services. And don't forget to subscribe and like this podcast. Also, ask yourself the 12 questions. Ask other people the 12 questions. I put this record out to stir debate and hopefully create change. So why don't you send us your answers to the 12 questions on Instagram and Twitter, at The Future Utopia. Last but not least, a massive shout out to Becky Voice at the Tape Agency, my management crew, Phil, Kate, Jasmine and Josh at 360 for helping make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. And until then, let's make the future a utopia.